Blog Talk Radio.
Sonic Effects. It's a pleasure to have you with us today, wherever you happen to be. I have to apologize for clogging up the path. You know that ubiquitous path that we're all following. Well, I thought I was being quite clever and I was walking along quite contentedly, and then it occurred to me that one of you had whispered to me that there's this point in a circle and that it has some special properties about it. And I thought, my goodness, the way my life is going, you know, error, correction, learn from the experience. What if it was possible that I didn't error anymore? What if that, you know, I know, the rantings and ravings of an old guy, but it struck me that I wasn't the only one that had been told this, that thousands and thousands and thousands, you know, a long time somebody had been passing on this pearl. And then it occurred to me, I can see it. I have right in front of me, I have a small maze, you know, one of those little forgings of Chartres. And it's wonderful, meditative when you're sitting, when I'm sitting and thinking, listening to music and trying to just infuse myself with an ease. How do I get there? Oh, you're the audience. You're the scientist. It's your lab. It's my lab. How do we get there? I can draw it. I can picture it in my mind, that point. Even within a circle. But how does one acquire that point? That's the rub, and that's the magic. And what if it's not so much what if, obviously there's lessons and the formula. My goodness, there's a formula that's given to us. And you wonder why I slow down in the path and you're coming along, just marching along as courageously as possible, picking up and absorbing everything there is to know. And here you come upon this scene where this old boy is leaned over and he's sort of got this grubby little book in his hand, and he sat down by the side of the path, and it's hard to skirt past him without noticing. He's muttering these words, from the hole we deduce this moral. What hole? Well, where do I recall that? That's from teaching somebody about the shop, isn't it? Teaching somebody about, you know, when you come in, you're not given the most exotic. We've got little steps. We've got small steps, not little, but small steps. We break down something more complex, and we teach you that way. we deduce this moral that knowledge grounded on accuracy, aided by labor and promoted by perseverance, will finally overcome. Well, that just took my breath away. Here I've been walking along and I see this beautiful plant. And I thought, oh, how nice. You know, it's pleasure to the eye and it has a pleasant fragrance and it even lingers in the air when you walk past. And then further down the road, I would see it again. And it just became like a commonplace. It wasn't nothing special. And I had not paid a whole lot of attention to it until I remembered your words. This is what you're giving me is a formula. And I think you're trying to encourage me to be, I don't know, to help both define the pathway to success and contentment, if that's what you and I have agreed to about happiness, is it that satisfaction? Yeah. Here it is. You've given it to me all these years, and I apologize for not picking it up. I'm looking for the beliefs of masonry, and they're hard, you know, they're hard to always define, and not everybody shares them. I guess there's a lot. I look down this road ahead of me, you know, that town where I am in Ontario, where you're driving along at the top of this enormous ridge, and at the bottom of it is this town. Small town, way up north. Gorgeous scene. It's like that. This path, I can see so far down this ridge, and it's full of pilgrims like me. And I can see just off in the distance through the mist, I can see glimmers of the color of this plant, this story, this information, this formula for success, I guess. And I find there's some people that are stopped and looking at it more closely and sitting by the road, and some have their head in their hands, and others are just merely charging along, more of them charging along than not, if I care to be honest about it. So the path has something to do with knowledge, huh? With knowledge, that knowledge of the physical world, if you don't mind me asking, is it knowledge of the metaphysical world, the spiritual world? Is it a combination? I don't know. Not sure. Is this about a control and awareness of thinking? Well, be honest, we've got a pretty untrained symphony of musicians right now. They're all going off in different compositions with their instruments tuned to different structures. If only we could coordinate. If only we could agree on certain standards so that we can enjoy the harmonies that are produced. Just even if it's the voice, can we just, what do we hear? You know, we just open our voice, and is it all that self-conscious, you know, that squeak? That here, one, two, and three, I'm too old to sing. Is it that? What have we got to lose? How's that silence been working for you so far, really? Yeah. What if we looked at this formula more seriously, and just for a second? No, not to bear down, not to turn us away from whatever mediocrity is distracting us in the moment. And it's beginning to annoy me that we're even learning about these the efforts of this form of psychology to control my attention, to that somebody can actually know and predict what's going to satisfy my attention. And, you know, I thought I was in charge of that all these years, some pretender to my psyche. Huh? I don't think so. I don't think so. But I appreciate this opportunity. And I understand, I think, why you didn't tell me this instruction was vital, because it wouldn't have mattered, huh? What's vital to you does not necessarily resonate to me, although there are times in life when I'm hanging on every syllable, looking for answers, needing, craving, fearing the alternative, the abyss, huh? You know, been there? It happens. It happens. Don't act so strange. It happens to you. It is a strangeness. But when you catch your breath again, and believe me, it takes a while, you look around and wonder truly how real special your experience has been on the face of the earth. It's a little bit humbling. Even the intensity, you know, we all have our idiosyncratic version of it, but even our intensity is unique to us, and it's unique to him and you. It's unique. It's a uniqueness that we share. Just like I was talking about the other day in my short talk, you want power? Clamor for the bigger gun, do you? The bigger switch, the bigger pile of whatever, to be able to compete, or do that if you will, and then compare it to that power of that little baby wrapping little tiny perfect fingers around your finger, even before she can open her tiny eyes, or he can. And you just brush against the back of that hand and he hangs on. There's a connection. Tell me your sense of power and importance and that. Not even a choice. We aren't given to observation. If you're thinking that means if we're not doing something, that it's the argument for inadequacy, well, that's a bit of a bias, isn't it? That's a bit of an attitude about yourself and humanity. I, on the other hand, choose not to accept that reality, and I insert my own. My Masonic reality has something to do with discovery, something to do with the aim coming to us that I believe Freemasonry is one of the most profound, the essence, you know, this learning, understanding, this knowledge that you told me about, that's supposed to, it's a moral. So this knowledge, this is a self-fulfilling prophecy. Oh, there, I said it out loud. Oh, a self-fulfilling prophecy. No, it's not the Constitution that brings Masonry forward. No, it's not the philosophies, as beautiful as they are. No, it's not the geometry or the virtues. All of those are important. All of those are important. But it's you. It's you. All these beautiful beakers of ideas in your laboratory. All of them. You think about it. I was thinking back in the 70s when I just, you know, when you're absorbing ideas in one of those quacky little environments that poor people mock, or either that or they clamor to enter. I was reading in a style that I'd not done before, and nobody told me I had, you know, it wasn't a requirement. It was a curiosity. What in the hell is all, what is this stuff about? The names will come clear to some of you, Herbert and Lem and Asimov, and Le Guin. The work of those writers opened up the mind through imagination. And they're pretty good at capturing the science of the day. If you're prone to think, to question whether a mathematician is too stiff to have imagination, check out that crazy Russian, Stanislav Lem. Ooh. Oh, man, fabulous writing. And all that it did wasn't dismissive. All that it did was open up the mind. More possibility. When your mind is open like that, just pour in the knowledge. The opinions are vast, and the command is the training of the mind to be able to effectively make effective choices with understanding, with an understanding of the logic and to be able to read the symbolic currency. Maybe the rabbis were right, I think, again. Knowledge can never be taken from you. When I first went to an opera many, many, many years ago, I didn't come from family that would take me by hand to the opera when I was a boy. No, this is something you discovered. And every time I made one of these discoveries, it meant leaving my peers, leaving what was familiar behind. And I have some regrets. I like to go out and kick a ball around with my friends or shoot a puck. I haven't done that for a long time. It's that audience. I thought this would be the elegance of La Scala. It was elegant in its way. The performance was everything that the professors had taught me and more. I can still, when I close my eyes, I can still remember the very first concert that I went to outside of the classroom. The audience. Everyone making an effort at polish. Some more refined. Some faces lived in, some faces lived for. And it just was like this exhilaration. The opera is there for the world. Oh, did I have a pang of conscience? Yeah. Here I am thinking this is elite or superior. Look around you there, young man. What do you see? Everybody from different walks of life. Some in evening wear, white tie, some in tuxedo, some in lovely, lovely, the ladies in lovely gowns. And we went out between acts for our sip of champagne. It was lovely, but in the around the energy, the chatter, that for me is how I measure performance, that energy that's conveyed to the audience. was everywhere. It didn't depend on the type of watch you had on or the bling, the jewelry, the elegance. Everything was elegant. Everything was elegant in its own way. It was absolutely stunning that penny dropped. It was for everyone. Knowledge, the experience, the refinement. It was to say that the shopkeeper should not enjoy Bizet or Beethoven's one opera. Who's to say this? I'm not. Who's to say that the refinements of life are only accorded to imperialist wishes, the elitist? What's the elite? The ego? Yeah. I tend to think as these plants of knowledge grow everywhere, that the messages, and I do know this, that the message, that insight that we clamor for, it doesn't just come once. No, don't kid yourself, or don't listen to a cynic that ever suggests, this is your one opportunity. Well, opportunity comes and goes, yeah. Probability, yeah. But if you're thinking that knowledge, that insight comes and goes, come on. It's repeated in the natural order of things. It's repeated. Now, what's also repeated is a tendency to ignore. how many old boys, lonely and bitter, have I met blaming their dissatisfaction on their partners all their life? Repeated. Darn those partners. So inadequate. And yet here he sits stewing in his own inadequacy. So vain, so proud, unable to acknowledge what's in front of him. Now, when people talk to me about sadness, that's the image that comes to mind. How sad. Wrapped in his own insecurity, huh? All this, and along comes this order offering this shopping list in a way, except I can't just buy the Stairway to Heaven, can I? I can't just go in and purchase this. I guess you could look at it metaphorically. What's the price? Am I willing to pay the price of getting to that point from which in I cannot err? Am I willing to put out like that? Well, huh. You tell me that this pathway to virtue, to happiness, is through virtue. Well, I can approximate what that means. I can evaluate my own life. I can kid you. You're not around. Nobody saw me. I can't kid myself. And then I watch the vulnerability of the world around unfolding. It's lovely. It's lovely. Today, this is the long form show, because I've broken Blog Talk into Masonic Effects into short talks, which I do a couple of times through the week for people that aren't inclined to listen to the kind of music we're about to, or the history or the poetry. Thank you for tuning in. My goodness, I'm so grateful. Right now, I need you to tell your friends to help me spread this program out there, because I think it's worthwhile. I think it has a voice in the clamor. And if you do, if you share it, not from the point of view of an elite, but that everybody deserves to. My goodness, I think that I don't understand the truth of what I'm saying, but I never fail to offer what I think is unvarnished truths. You decide. That helps the awkwardness this journey, this imperative, this self-fulfilling prophecy here. Let this you'll know the tune quite readily. This is from his performance in Tokyo in 1984. Oh, no pun intended. Keith Jarrett. That'll do. That is gorgeous. For many of us, as the weeks pass, we begin to realize an illusion. Time seems to accelerate. When I think of about a week, the mindset of being a 14 or 15-year-old version of me compared to now, it used to be painful. A week before something would begin, or a week until something would end, just it had to be endured. How can I, how am I going to get through this? This is just, and now it goes past in the blink of an eye. The speed of experiences and images and memories. We begin to realize an illusion that time seems to accelerate. Either that or the list of things we want to experience and accomplish grows and grows until we realize there might not be enough time. Priorities begin to matter more. Satisfaction with what we have is not such a meaningless phrase. A pill isn't enough to settle our minds and control emotion. We notice a forgotten name for a face so familiar, the misplaced penknife reminding us to focus. So many distractions, so many determinations, so many choices. Is life over, or am I still prone to influences? Can I change my ways? Oh, no sense pretending that the sun shines out of me. Yeah, there's an honesty that comes with the age and experience. Dare I attempt something so strange to live a good life? Ah, the charm of self-delusion. We fail to see the advantage of efforts that matter in the big scheme of things. And along the way, our group shrinks. At entrance, we are hundreds and thousands. Each year, we stream ourselves according to the filters. Interest is one of them, ability another, diligence a third. And with each, the group thins out until learning becomes conversational, an exchange of ideas, informed conversation. Being challenged until the student becomes the master and then the source. Until we acknowledge talent, often not our own, but that of others. And if we are lucky, we exchange influences with talent. Each day, asking ourselves if happiness is close at hand, while trying to understand if it is beauty that brings about the state of mind, happiness. Thank you. Like a little Ben Webster when you're sipping away at a glass of cognac. Here, what could he possibly bring us that would enhance that mood? Well, I've been lately indulging myself, as if you need an excuse, in the work of a beautiful poet. And it's just that the poets, why poetry, it's just that they reveal so darn much that it's constant reminders. I don't know. I don't really get a sense that it's intrusive. Or, for some of my uninspired teachers, when I think of very few of my teachers as a schoolboy, I think maybe one had the imagination of to introduce you to poetry. Others, it was the command, you do this, don't ask why. Because they didn't know. They didn't know. They were getting a paycheck. Yeah. Oh. And this is the way most children are taught in our environments, and we know that. The the work of an Irishman, though, seems, I don't know, almost irresponsible in an environment where the clamor is only to see the result and not the immorality that got us to the result. Mm-hmm. This is about a guy, interesting guy, he's well situated in life, you know, he's well educated, born in 1865. So, you know, as Freemasonry was building the bureaucracy, you know, we need to keep proper records. We had enough of a Germanic tilt to us. Along comes the intellect of a man who is forced to choose perfection of the life or of the work. So says this guy, W.B. William Butler Yeats. Yeah. Died 10 years before I was born. 1939 he died, passed away. And he was an interesting man. He's been described as a chameleon of sorts, you know. And I think that's an apt, not that I've studied his entire career. He went from the pre-Raphaelite fairy and the Irish revival and the mystic Rosicrucian and the fascist flirtation. And he got better and humbler and more sincere over the years. He once remarked that when he was young, his muse was old. But now he was old, his muse was young. Oh, isn't that there's something I'll go away. And that's a little brain worm you're not going to leave. 1923, he did win the Nobel Prize. And quote, for his always inspired poetry, which in a highly artistic form gives expression to the spirit of a whole nation. Auden, yeah, that Auden, was accurate and unusually complimentary in memory of William Butler Yeats. As he said in his line, you were silly like us. Your gift survived it all. But interesting fellow, yeah. He had an involvement with an excursion with one of the bad boys of Freemasonry, Aleister Crowley. He's described as an English magician and founder of the religion of Thelema. And he's been admired as a powerful theorist and practitioner of what he called magique, and reviled as a spoiled, abusive buffoon. Somewhere between those two camps, we find the opinion of Crowley's bitter rival, the Irish poet William Butler Yeats, once passionately wrote that the study of magic was the most important pursuit of my life. The mystical life is the center of it all that I do and all that I think and all that I write. Bitter rival? Crowley would surely say the same, but his magic was of a much darker, more obsessive variety, and his success as a poet insignificant next to Yeats. Crowley was jealous. He was never able to speak the language of poetic symbol with the confidence of a native speaker in the same way Yeats definitely could. But the biographer, Richard Ellman, tells a different story, dryly reporting on the conflict of its participants as a genuine war between competing forms of practical magic. Having been ejected from the occult theosophical society for his magical experiments, Yeats joined the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. No, you're looking at the work of Madame Blavatska. Interesting. I've got one of her books here. A very dear old friend gave me one day. And the Order of the Golden Dawn, even more esoteric or exotic, really, it claimed direct descent from the Hermetic tradition of the Renaissance and into remote antiquity. But Yeats' beloved Irish revolutionary Maud Gonne, the famous musicians Arthur Edward Waite, that Waite, and Crowley, these were all at various times part of the order. Mm-hmm. But when Crowley showed a tendency to use his occult powers for evil rather than good, The biographer writes, the adepts of the order, Yeats among them, decided not to allow him to be initiated into the inner circle. And they feared he would profane the mysteries and unleash powerful magic forces against humanity. Crowley's ouster led to a confrontation in 1900 that might make you think, depending on your frame of reference, of the warring magicians on South Park. I mean, if you've seen that, Crowley refused to accept their decision. And after some astral attacks on Yeats, quote, in Highlander's tartan with a black crusader's cross on his breast, Crowley arrived at the Golden Dawn Temple in London, making the sign of the pentacle inverted and shouting menaces at the adepts. Crowley climbed the stairs, but Yeats and two other white magicians came resolutely forward to meet him, ready to protect the holy place at any cost. And when Crowley came within range, the forces of good struck out with their feet and kicked him downstairs. It's almost slapstick vanquishing became known as the Battle of Blythe Road and has been immortalized in a publication by that very name. Check it out. With accounts from Crowley, Yeats, and the Golden Dawn adepts William Westcott and Florence Farr and others, they put the boots to the idiot. But the war was not won, as the biographer cites, and Crowley went forward with converts or victims in London, while Yeats attempted to stop him with the requisite spells and exorcisms. One such spell supposedly sent a vampire that bit and tore at his flesh as it lay beside Crowley all night. Despite Yeats' supernatural interventions, one of Crowley's targets, a young painter named Althea Giles, was finally forced to give way entirely to his baleful fascinations. Hellman's, the biographer, humorous and unsettling narrative shows us Crowley as predator, characterization of a wealthy Englishman had apparently earned, and his responsible governments excluded him from one country after another, lest he bring to bear their inhabitants his hostile, sacred, psychic ray. Yeats was a bouncer, saw him off the premises, called in the police, and ended up victorious in court. Yeats and the other members' distaste for Crowley surely had something to do with his predatory behavior. But the rivalry was also indeed a poetic one, albeit extremely one-sided. Yeats and what have you. Crowley viewed the occult as a source of personal power. So, he was known as the wickedest man in the world. That's what he was called. But Yeats, the poet, in this, I'll just give you a little bit here. He takes the reader on a journey into a collective subconscious of Celtic pagan mentality in this poem. Wandering Angus. So this is, he refers to Angus, the Irish god of love. And that, help me here, it's A-E-N-G-U-S, Angus. And he was said to be a young, handsome god that had four birds flying around his head. And these birds symbolized kisses and inspired love for all who heard them. In the poem, The Song of Wandering Angus, one can clearly see Yeats' fascination with the occult, creating classic pagan and Celtic myths as a means of creating an alternative reality for his own nationalistic intentions. His occult experiments confirmed his nationalism, and his nationalism in some way justified his magical experiments. Maud Gonne is more than the tangible woman for Yeats. She is a symbol of all that he is trying to attain. And therefore, Gonne is not only the physical woman, but also the new Irish race reaching fruition. And in this poem, Yeats magically transports the reader into a Celtic collective consciousness, subconsciousness, where a union between him and Maud is displayed as the hopeful salvation of the Irish race. I went out to the hazelwood because a fire was in my head and cut and peeled a hazel wand and hooked a berry on a thread. And when white moths were on the wing and moth-like stars were flickering out, I dropped the berry in a stream and caught a little silver trout. I had laid it on the floor. I went to blow the fire aflame, but something rustled on the floor and someone called out, "Call me a name." It had become a glimmering girl with an apple blossom in her hair who called me by my name and ran and faded through the brightening air. When the time began to rant and rage, the measure of her flying feet made Ireland's heart begin to beat. Yet he who treads in measured ways may surely barter gaze for gaze. Man ever journeys on with them after the red rose bordered hem. Fairies dancing under the moon, a druid land, a druid tomb. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping low, dropping from the veils of the morning to where the crickets sing. There midnight's all a glimmer and noon a purple glow and evening full of the linnet's wings. On a visit to Ireland in 1889, he met the beautiful Irish patriot Maud Gunn. He fell unrequitedly in love with her for the rest of his life. He also proposed to, after she turned him down, he proposed to her daughter, Isla, in 1917. So Maud, in a way, was his muse and inspired much of his early work and drew him into the Irish nationalist movement for independence. His later writings, sort of antediluvian, were generally acknowledged to be his best. And they were influenced by Georgie Hyde Lees, his wife from 1917, who claimed to have a mysterious medium's gift for automatic writing. Partly a product of this spiritualist activity, his writing, A Vision, is an elaborate attempt to, in prose, to explain the arcane mythology, arcane mystery, symbolism, and philosophy that Yeats used in much of his work. And he did diagrams. He collaborated with his wife's mysterious communicators to describe cyclical patterns of cosmic force called the gyres. Of course, what do we do with the likes of this? What do we do? He's so unconventional. It can't be good. Can't be good. No. Can it? Thank you. Transformative nature of Freemasonry, making, it's like if we want to create a beautiful meal, we know that it relies on an aesthetic and the quality of the ingredients and the talent of the chef. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the joie de vivre, the conversation, the people that pull their chairs in under the table at the table to enjoy and savor. No, I'm not talking about the mutations that immediately take it to complain about their weight or be pious about their selection of ingredients. I'm non-something or other. It's the atmosphere. It's like enjoy it. Get into it. But you know the type that are distracted as soon as they sit down, no matter what it is. It's because they've lost track of merit. They've lost track of the point. It's just like what your granny told you. Pay attention, boy. Pay attention. Without your grandfather, in my case, it's my grandfather. I tell him once and that's all. And it's followed me. You know? Tell me once. And then I'll remind myself as I plod along that what we're talking about historically now, this is Jacob, you know? Yeah, this is Margaret Jacob, historian, pulling this out. That she was fascinated with this form of transformation from the qualities, you know, the attributes ascribed to church and state to merit. Remember how many soldiers went to slaughter because they were commanded by the sons of the wealthy and elite that were absolutely untrained. We can look at the darkness and the lightness of professional soldiering. And it's always been the case in some parts of the world, but where there has been a study, we know that from our examination of generals as far back as the Romans and before that period of time. But over the top, let's just throw our might, prance around in bright uniforms that stand in contrast with the background. What do you decide? Is that pride and power? Is that an expression of pride and power or sheer and utter disarray, loss of morality? That soldier's life is worth less than mine. Oh, I'm a commander, but I'm behind the lines. I'll send you into that battle, marching. And let's make noise and bring attention to ourselves while these other people disguise themselves and camouflage. So we're talking about an extraordinary transformation happening in the 1770s, 1790s. This is going on in the landscape around us. This isn't ownership or production. This is echoing. And it was influential because, you know, a certain mindset was attracted to it. An extraordinary transformations would inevitably entail a massive reform and alteration of the old order, according to Jacobs. A break from the past so abrupt as to constitute a new and secular form of apocalyptic action. On the continent, the break took the form of a series of revolutions which Masonic rhetoric and idealism with its British and utopian associations may have at moments made seem more plausible. In their country of origin, however, most Masonic orators encouraged order and stability and accommodation to the social and political status quo. Indeed, the lodges were an important vehicle for inculcating loyalism to king and government. Only in the area of religious belief was the emphasis on toleration, a religion among which all men agree, radically out of step with the prevailing values and mores and British, indeed, of every European society. This was a rhetorical more Whig than Tory, more court than country, although, as we have seen, not without radical associations. This is the first instance the force and challenge inherent in British Masonic idealism lie in the area of religious values, beliefs, and mores. Freemasonry exported upon the continent a peculiarly English religiosity, the legacy of liberal Protestantism with its emphasis on natural religion. It had been forged by nearly a half century of revolution and under the impact of the new science. Yet it could and did travel and translate as attractive across the channel, much to the concern of police and clergy. And when we enter into these fraternal gatherings on the continent, we are observing a cultural transformation. British ceremonies, rituals, and language are being translated in new cultural settings, utterly specific to their time, place, and language. Rituals created among working men are now being used to express the dedication to originally British laws and constitutions. Much of the ritual will be reworked and elaborated upon by continental lodges. Yet the core of the idealism just outlined will, with its utopian cast, will remain recognizable in various European languages well into the 1780s. And it will continue to attract men of the middling ranks as well as the aristocracy. But in the history ahead, the original guild moorings of the lodges will be left behind in Scotland and England, as will the parliament and constitution within which the gentlemen of the original lodges draw from a variety of religious backgrounds and enjoy their liberties and privileges. Things were changing. Eh? This brings us to a close of the program for today. I hope you've enjoyed it, but not just in and of itself. I hope it gives us a moment to rethink. Have those influences faded, or are they less obvious? I wonder if our situation would be different if we were much more protective, or if we valued our secrecy and privacy more than we do today. All the conspirators listening in might be thinking that it's all one great big unified mass hysteria, but it isn't. It's about influences and your choice. What's better for you? And if you reject that notion, oh, that's, you know, that's fine. That's life. That's natural order. If you're looking to define improvement, that's something that needs to be done carefully. And only an individual can decide that. What's better and best for me and for my family and for my children and for my community and country? Oh, there's always going to be a confrontation. Values being what they are and prone to manipulation and, you know, autocrats being what they are. And yet, you know, maybe it's not so foolish to think that we will be able to suppress the individuality to the extent that we need to find explanations that allow us to be who we are and what we are, and yet to live in harmony. The whip doesn't do it. Well, what does? Well, I think that's part of the beauty of Freemasonry. I look forward to being with you again. Tune in through week. Check out my short talks. They'll be listed as such. Thanks for being here. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness.